Thanks for tuning in for the March 17th podcast. I'm Bob Gross, editor-in-chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's featured interview highlights a talk on the future of care and preserving the patient-physician relationship. For our other segment, you'll hear a discussion on blood neurofilament light levels and effects on MS treatment.
Hey, I'm Jason Crowell, and today it is my great honor to welcome John Noseworthy back to the podcast. John is a neurologist, an MS specialist, a leader here in the U.S. in healthcare policy, and from 2009 until 2018, he served as president and CEO of Mayo Clinic. He also served as editor-in-chief of the journal Neurology from 2007 until 2009, stepping down to take over at Mayo Clinic. And we at the podcast are quick to point out that John started the Neurology Podcast back in 2007, and of course, we greatly appreciate that. Some of you who have been listening to us for a few years will recall that former Neurology Podcast editor Ted Burns interviewed John back in 2017 on the February 14th podcast. So if you haven't listened to that one, I encourage you to do that after you listen to this interview. Today, we're discussing John's special report published in the New England Journal of Medicine on December 5th, 2019, titled The Future of Care, Preserving the Patient-Physician Relationship. John, thank you for your time and for joining us this week.
Thanks, Jason. It's great to be back.
Before we dive in, I was talking with Ted Burns about our interview today, and we were discussing how the Neurology Podcast has surpassed 20 million downloads since you started it in 2007. And Ted was wondering briefly if you ever imagined that we would have reached such a milestone.
Well, congratulations to you and Ted. Ted did a fabulous job launching this, as you know, and all the credit goes to Ted and his team. I didn't know really where it would go, to be honest, Jason, obviously. But when I received a letter from a very senior and well-known national figure in neurology after maybe a year of the podcast, and he said, John, thank you for doing this. I have macular degeneration. I can no longer read the journal. This keeps me in touch with my colleagues and with my profession. I knew we had something that was pretty special. So I'm delighted that it's thriving, and thank you for all the work you and Ted are doing.
Of course. I think it's a labor of love here for those of us that work the podcast. The last time you were on the podcast, Ted asked you to do a quick SWOT analysis of the U.S. healthcare system, covering its strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. And that podcast was recorded in the first week or two of the Trump presidency, and there was quite a bit of uncertainty about how policies were going to change, including whether or not the Affordable Care Act would be repealed and replaced. So now here we are in early 2020, and there are daily conversations about various Medicare for All proposals. The price of prescription drugs leads the polls as Americans' greatest healthcare concern. Can you comment on how things have changed over the last few years, and how would you assess the U.S. healthcare system's strengths and weaknesses, how those have changed?
Well, things have changed a lot, and they haven't changed that much. And let me just go into that a little bit. I always try to be as optimistic and upbeat as I can be. And I think one of the things that we're seeing over the last 3 to 5 years is that healthcare has become the number one issue for many, many Americans. And that's number one, two, or three on the minds of everybody. And this fear of problems with access and managing costs, and particularly medical bankruptcy, remain huge. And I think the fact that Americans are now very aware of the costs of their health care and whether or not they and their family will continue to have access to health care, that that's a tabletop issue for people, is really important, because the next steps, that is to continue to work to design and sustain a high-quality healthcare system for everybody, we're going to need an awful lot of input from many sectors, particularly the patients and particularly the physicians. So the fact that patients are becoming more aware, they may be more frightened, that's not a good thing, but they're more aware of how tenuous this is, I think that's a good thing. The things that haven't changed is the issues remain. The two leading issues, as you said, are access and cost and sustainability. From the public's perspective, the public health issues are very well known. The opiate crisis, gun violence, mental health issues, fetal maternal mortality, obesity, lack of education, particularly for preschool. All those issues are huge public health issues. They remain. The public is wrestling with them. Entrepreneurs and innovators are trying to come up with new ideas of how to approach those. That's a good thing. The ACA is still controversial in the minds of many. It's become more popular the longer it's been in place with the public. And the issues really are, is will it be overturned by the lower court and then the Supreme Court in the next 18 months or not? And that would cause chaos. The expansion of Medicaid, which has been quite dramatic but is still stalled in many states, is one of the leading causes of growing health disparity in the country. There's an article out today of it's no longer economic, if you will, or societal, it's more geographic. So where Medicaid has expanded, healthcare has improved, lives have been saved. Some states are still resisting that. I don't expect a lot to happen between now and the end of 2020 with the election looming, but this issue of what are the options for Americans will obviously be front and center with the next president, either President Trump again or with the next person. Whether they take that on in all its complexity right away or not remains to be seen. So it's become more of a concern to more people, but the key issues of access and cost remain.
I'd like to turn to the article that you wrote for the New England Journal. Again, you were asked to be the Shattuck lecturer. Could you tell us a little bit about that lecture and how you decided to write about this topic, the future of care?
The Shattuck lecture has been in place now for 129 years, I believe. Some very prominent people in the profession, including William Osler and most recently Bill Gates, have been the Shattuck lecturers. So having read the most of my career, it was a huge honor to be asked by Jeff Drazen to consider doing this. A little daunting. The one question I asked Jeff is, well, obviously, Jeff, why me and what are you hoping to achieve? He said, well, the medical profession itself is pretty beat up right now. We usually write about medical breakthroughs or societal issues, but we'd like to talk a bit about what are the issues that are impacting the physicians in practice. So that piqued my interest, to be honest. And I said, well, do you want me to talk about the future of care or the future of medicine? And he said, why are you making that difference? And I said, well, the future of medicine is basically includes the role of technology, innovation, research, education, entrepreneurship, and so on. And he said, no, I want you to talk about the future of care. And then I said, well, then, Jeff, I will be thrilled to do it because so much has been written about what's going to happen with artificial intelligence and molecular imaging and genomics and regenerative medicine and so on. But I really did want to talk about the future of care. And in my sense, I believe strongly that the future of care will go astray if we lose what brought us into this profession, which is that doctor-patient relationship. And how do we help the patients, particularly those who are struggling with undiagnosed or serious and progressive illnesses, and those who are struggling with managing their treatments and so on. And that's something that I felt we needed to highlight. So in a sense, it's a little bit of an old-fashioned article. It talks about the principles that probably drove you. I know they drove me to go into the profession, but I want to make sure that we shine a bright light on that so that if others in the profession agree that those are hallowed and necessary for our success as a profession, that we can draw attention to it and work together to see if we can make that more secure.
You discuss in this paper the friction, as you just mentioned, that exists between patient care and the business side of healthcare, including cost, productivity, regulatory requirements. I'm sure most of us who are clinicians can think back to a time when we were going through training. I know I can. When you first start to recognize that this friction exists, and sometimes we as clinicians are caught in the middle of it. Could you talk about this friction and how you see it affecting clinicians and the care that we provide our patients?
Well, this friction between medicine as a profession and medicine as a business is now very much in the minds of practicing physicians, nurses, pharmacists, and so on. And it's insidious because it's in the back of your mind every minute, or at least it's there in the room with you and your patient as you're trying to do your job, which is sort out how you can help them, what the diagnosis is, take the history, do the exam, and so on. Patients are frightened. They're generally concerned about their insurance. No one has extra money these days to pay for expensive things. And it's just like a third party in the room, it seems to me, with every patient encounter. And so many of them are really trapped in the complexity of healthcare. That's number one. Number two, for anyone who is a leader in healthcare, and that could be being the lead physician of your group practice or the head of a committee at your regional hospital or department chair or beyond that, or even within the academy, you're aware that medicine isn't a charity. Medical practice may be a nonprofit organization where you may be part of a for-profit chain. I'm not really speaking to them, but most of us are part of academic medicine or private practice, which is affiliated with nonprofit hospitals that support the community. We still have to be looking at, are we sustainable financially? And how can we supplement the cost of care of the majority of the patients in the system who are Medicare or Medicaid, over 65 or disabled or underinsured? How do we give them the best care we can, and yet the practice, the hospital, the university, the private healthcare organization, whatever it is, remains sustainable so we can keep going forward, recruit the right people, invest in technology and advances and health records and so on. And in my experience, physicians generally don't want to think about billing issues and cost issues because they didn't go into business. They went into medicine. So it's always there. It's complex, and we just need to be aware of it so we can deal with it.
Now, you discussed two specific principles in this article as pertaining to preserving the patient-physician relationship. Could you discuss those?
The two principles were the principles of a salaried physician, which I didn't talk about. But there's a salaried physician who is supported to spend the time needed with the patients who need the time. Not every patient needs a lot of time, as I mentioned in the article. And nurses and nurse practitioners and so on are necessary and can help with that. But when the physician is the right person to spend that extra time with the patient and the family, that needs to be granted to meet their needs. In addition to time face-to-face with patients and families when they need it, the majority of patients with serious and complex illness are being seen by other physicians, other specialists, and patients are aware that there's often a gap. Who's coordinating this? How are we going to get at the answer to my question without repeating tests, without a lot of waste of time and energy? And that's the concept of, for some groups in some situations, identifying a coordinating physician who's going to be essentially the quarterback to tie all this together. We know this. If you don't spend the right amount of time with patients or you feel hurried, and some physicians will say, well, let's do more tests. But as Osler said, listen to the patient. They're telling you what's wrong with them. In neurology, particularly, getting the history right, getting the exam right, does help one get to the proper diagnosis quickly and efficiently. And when you have the right diagnosis, you can provide the best possible care. When you don't have the right diagnosis, it's a really tough issue for the patient and for the healthcare system because there's tremendous waste that's brought in, repeated tests, errors, delays in diagnosis, and that's where time with patients and the coordinating physician are so important. I also think that insufficient time and not knowing who is caring for the patient not only upsets the patients tremendously, we all know that, but it's a huge dissatisfier for us as professionals. So for the right situation, depending on the practice that our neurologists who are listening are involved with, looking to see how could I get more time with the patients that need it, either in the initial diagnostic evaluation or when they're failing treatment, how do I bring that into the practice? And similarly, how do we assign who's really coordinating the care for this patient so we can all work together and avoid fragmentation and waste? And in the action items in the paper, I said, you know, if this is something that you need to look at yourself, you and your partners, practice redesign, developing teams to support you and the patient, here are some steps that you can try to get that started.
Yeah, I'm sure that both of those points, insufficient time and uncoordinated care, strike a chord with many of our listeners who experience that on a daily basis. And so, as you just alluded to, how can we start to make improvements in those areas?
And I would encourage our listeners, who a few of them are solo practitioners, Jason, but most of them are in a group. And most of them have some sort of support system around them. People in the office, perhaps nurses, appointment people, people that do the billing, people that do the dictation, whatever. That's a team, and that team can help unload the physicians and appropriately assign tasks to every member of that team in a very innovative way. And actually, at the Shattuck Lecture in Boston, it was a whole day devoted to this. I was just the keynote speaker. And the amount of innovation and things that people have done themselves in their group practices was really quite striking. And again, that's owning your practice so you don't get burned out and so you provide better care to your patients. I think at the association level, at the American Academy level, at lobby levels in Washington and so on, there's lots that can be done. But I think for most of us in the practice, this is something we can own ourselves with our partners.
I'd like to specifically discuss the point that you make in the article about changing reimbursement to reward these additional patient services, because I think many clinicians would agree that the value of our system would be improved if we had more time with our patients and if there was better coordination of care. But we all know that these services may require more clinician time. And so the obvious question becomes how to convince payers that these services are ultimately worth the investment on the front end. So can you talk about how we can change reimbursement models to give physicians more time with patients and to compensate physicians for coordinating care?
I would love to talk about that. I think depending on how the practice is conformed, some of that can be done internally. In other words, if it's a priority for, let's say, a multidisciplinary neurology group to recognize that they will be the distinguished practice in their community, in their city, in their region, if they bring this to the fore themselves, and it becomes clear that if you go to this particular group, they will listen to you, they will take time with you, they will work to get the answers right, and they will help coordinate your care. And that's a distinguishing characteristic of that particular practice. Now, it involves juggling schedules, being innovative, sorting out how we can do that. It could be done by a group practice on their own as an effort, essentially, to build their brand locally. And I would recommend people look at that. Secondly, in order to convince payers, the government and the third-party payers, it's probably going to take data. And for that to happen, it's going to take a prospective study of some sort, I would believe. And that could be done through the influence of the American Academy of Neurology, in my opinion. Because everyone knows that nobody knows what's wrong with the patients when they come to a neurologist. And getting the answer correct and quickly with an appropriate amount of intervention and testing, there's a business model for that. And there are groups that are beginning to look at that and then coming forward and saying, if it's a complex diagnostic situation, we recommend this coding be put in place. If it's coordinating care, you have to say, well, the uncoordinated care costs this, the coordinated care costs that. There are lots of anecdotal stories. As you mentioned, I had an MS practice. You know, patients who had come to see me from around the country generally had been to 3 or 4 or 5 other places. And as approximately 30% of them were misdiagnosed, the amount of waste in that system for that particular patient, as well as longstanding suffering, unnecessary testing, unnecessary treatment, side effects, et cetera, is staggering. But if you're going to change actually the billing system and the reimbursement system, that's another whole level of complexity that would require administrative support, I would say, across the academy, at least, and working with Washington and so on. But in the meantime, I think that most of our members are part of a group, and most groups can do this. It's not trivial, and I suspect many are already well down this path. But to create a multidisciplinary team to support and change old habits, at least at Mayo, we found it took a year to a year and a half to get those teams in place and working. It's not as simple as having a simple meeting and the physician saying, "Now I want you to do this and do that." That's often what happens is physicians feel they have the answer. They tell the nurses or the desk attendants what to do, the technicians in the EMG lab what to do. And that's a big mistake in our experience. If you bring everyone to the table and say, how can we do this better? Some of the best ideas come from the secretarial and administrative staff, and you want to engage them in a more creative solution.
Terrific. Thank you for covering these points, John. I think it's really helpful for our audience to think about these things. If you'll allow me to shift for just a question or two, I already referenced Ted's interview with you back in 2017. In that interview, Ted asked several questions about your career arc and the many different hats that you've worn throughout your career. But I'd like to know at what point in your career you decided to transition into administration and what drove you to make this shift, because you've obviously been very successful on many different levels. And I think it'd be helpful for our audience to hear how you decided to make this jump.
Well, thanks for asking about the arc of my career. Essentially, like I suspect most of us, I went into medicine because I wanted to be a physician. I wanted to help patients, and I found it interesting, and neurology was obviously a growing area of great opportunity. And that has remained the foundation of everything that I've done. To be honest, Jason, I never made a decision to go into administration. I was asked to do something. I enjoyed working with administrators. I enjoyed problem solving in the practice, in research, in education. And one thing kind of led to another. I was very fortunate in that physician leadership was assumed, was needed, and we were always paired with a good administrator who could help us decide how to make things better. Again, when I was department chair, when I was editor of the Green Journal, I was still seeing patients approximately half the time, maybe 3/4 of the time. I had to cut back, and then I actually had to stop seeing patients when I became the CEO. I tried to do it for a couple of years, but I just couldn't manage it. It wasn't a good thing for the patients. They would come to see me, and I would be called away. It was hard to keep up, all the usual things. But physicians don't like to talk about this, but we need leaders in medicine. And increasingly, I think the profession is realizing that physician-led organizations do very well and may do better than those run by administrators, because the physicians understand the science, they understand the patients, they understand their colleagues, They have validity with their colleagues. And when they say to other physicians, you know, we need to change how we're working in the hospital because this isn't working quite right, or the patients aren't, whatever. And if the physician who's jumped into that leadership role has the respect of and the chops recognized by their peers, it helps a lot. If you've not seen patients, you don't have any face validity with your colleagues, and they're not going to want to follow you because you don't understand their everyday needs. So part of the Shattuck lecture is a call out to the profession to say, look, we've taken a back seat. And to be honest, we've not been at the table when all these things have been done to us. The more physicians who stay active in the practice, that's important if you're going to know how to make things go forward. And if you're going to lead others, it helps to have that street cred with your colleagues. So that's kind of my story.
John, one final question. After serving as the CEO of Mayo Clinic for almost a decade, I'm interested, how do you spend your time nowadays?
Thanks, Jason. I retired a year ago, so I'm no longer at Mayo Clinic. That's the way we do it there, unless I went back into the practice, which was an option. But having been out for 10 years, it would have been difficult to do. So I'm no longer at Mayo Clinic. I still love the organization and help them where I can. I'm actually taking a bit of time to decide what next to do. I'm involved with a couple of boards, one private, one public. I'll do some advising for an investment bank. But I'm actually spending a lot of time with my wife, which is wonderful, and my family and my grandkids, and doing some of the things that I always wanted to do and never could. So I'm not sure what will ultimately happen during this next phase of my life, but that's how I'm spending it now.
That's wonderful to hear. For our listeners, once again, I strongly encourage you to check out John's article. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine on December 5th, titled The Future of Care, Preserving the Patient-Physician Relationship. John, you've been very gracious with your time. Thanks so much for joining us for this conversation.
Thanks very much for asking, Jason. Take care.
This is David Lapidus at the University of Virginia. Our listeners may recall several podcasts we've done on neurofilament light with Matthias Jucker on neurofilament light and Alzheimer's on April 22, 2019, and with Pashtun Shahim on May 9, 2017 on mild TBI and contact sports, just to name a few. And neurology, neuroimmunology, and neuroinflammation also recently had an issue at the end of 2019 with an article on the clinical application of neurofilament light chain in multiple sclerosis. So clearly, NFL research is hot, but are we really on the brink of clinical application? To answer that question with me today, I'm joined by Fredrik Peel, professor of neurology at the Karolinska Institute at Stockholm, Sweden. He's here to discuss his paper, Blood Neurofilament Light Levels, Segregate Treatment Effects in Multiple Sclerosis Patients, published in this issue of Neurology. Fredrik, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, David, for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
So your team analyzed the plasma neurofilament light levels of patients with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis before and after being started on a variety of therapies, including alemtuzumab, dimethyl fumarate, fingolimod, natalizumab, or teriflunomide. You had a heterozygous group of participants. And what exactly did your team find?
Yeah, we collected plasma from all over Sweden. And this is in context of a national program to follow all different types of treatments we use for MS. So this really represents a real-world cohort. It's not a selected group of patients. It's what we regularly see in our clinics. So what we could see is that if you just look at the crude values of neurofilament, it's obvious that some patients, let's say patients that starts on high effective therapy from start, like natalizumab, you see that most patients then decrease in neurofilament levels, whereas you don't see that with certain other types of treatments where starting levels might be lower. But we did quite a lot of statistical work out to reduce the impact of different baseline characteristics that we can control for, like having a relapse before starting therapy. And what we then could see, which I think is kind of the most important take-home message from this study, is that there are different effects of treatment. So generally speaking, high effective treatments lower neurofilament levels and actually normalize them, whereas more, let's say, first-line platform therapies don't do that. So this is an argument for high-effective treatments being more, well, as the name says, it's more effective.
Wonderful. So were there any specific standouts that you can name, namely any drug that altered the level more or less than another? Or were there perhaps situations when a disease was not well controlled, as you said, a relapse, and the neurofilament light level correlated and then later decreased after perhaps a second drug was started?
Well, statistically speaking, we could identify three different groups. So alemtuzumab was the drug that lowered the levels most. And then we had an intermediate group with natalizumab, dimethylfumarate, and fingolimod, and the third one, teriflunomide, which lowered levels the least. We didn't look at patients doing switches and looking what happened later. That's something we have to address at a later stage.
Great. And because it's too expensive to really run clinical trials comparing each of these medications, this blood test is really helping to establish a tiered level of aggressive therapy, namely alemtuzumab being the most impactful therapy with regards to the degree of change of neurofilament light, fingolimod, natalizumab, and dimethyl fumarate on the next level, and teriflunomide below that. But we're not quite ready to use neurofilament light clinically to help monitor MS patients, if I understand correctly. What's better about neurofilament light, for example, than something like volumetric measurements?
Well, volumetrics is certainly a very kind of attractive measure. But at the group level, you know, if you have a group of patients, then 12 months may be enough to look at something. But it's pretty worthless at an individual level to look at MRI volumetrics in 12-month time. Maybe you need 2, maybe 4 years to get more kind of safe data. So neurofilament certainly is something reacts earlier. If you have a patient that is stable on medication and there's some remaining disease activity, it will take years to show up in the volumetric measurements. So it's quicker to react.
Could this be used as a correlate? How do you see working the neurofilament light levels into an annual or semi-annual patient evaluation with regards to MRI monitoring and clinical examination?
Well, in one way, I think that the thing about introduction in wide clinical practice is seldom something that comes at a certain specific time point. I think there's a gradual kind of movement where there's enough evidence today for, let's say, early adopters to start using or analyzing neurofilament and see how it works in clinical practice. I think we're at that point now. From our paper, one of the important things is that a single measurement probably doesn't say much, especially if you already have started the therapy. So you would need longitudinal sampling and maybe doing it 2-3 times a year for a couple of years to really get the feeling if the therapy works or not. This is a little bit like what we do already with clinical checkups and MRI. The thing is that I think neurofilament could add something to what we can see with MRI because we usually only scan the brain and not the spinal cord. And neurofilament also picks up disease processes that affect the normal appearing white matter. So it's a kind of global measurement of neuroaxonal degeneration and not only what can be seen as focal lesions.
That's wonderful and really exciting. So as we started off with, we said neurofilament light research within neurology is used in TBI, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, ALS, just to name a few. So are we really on the brink of clinical application in terms of actually being able to send my patient down to the lab and feasibly send this lab out simply?
Yeah, I think we're really there or close to that. And I think there's also a very good practical motive because if we want to analyze something and send something away and perhaps maybe not the local lab can analyze this, you need to send it to a central lab. A very good thing about neurofilament is that it's a very robust molecule. So we showed in a previous paper that we sent samples by surface mail, and it didn't really matter if it took 1 day or 5 days for the sample to arrive. Levels were similar. So that's a very good advantage of neurofilament light. It wouldn't take really costly kind of shipment procedures, so you could actually ship it in a normal letter. I don't know what's the average day for U.S. Post, but probably not worse than the Swedish mail service. So that's good.
I don't know either, maybe. So overall, your work has found that there really are some differences between high efficacy medications and lower efficacy medications with regards to the degree that they actually impact the neurofilament light levels. And this could really be practical in that it can help decrease expensive imaging. It's a very clinically feasible test in that it's a shelf-stable molecule that can handle itself in the mail. And overall, over the course of repeating this test over months and years, we really will start to see how these levels are impacted by different therapies, and that's how it will start being infused into daily practice. So it sounds like the sooner we start actually testing this regularly, the sooner it will be clinically applicable, given the fact that we need more time points points in order to make it more accessible for interpretation.
I agree. I mean, it's a little bit like when we started to use the MRI. Previously, in the initial stages, we ran it as a diagnostic tool and didn't scan our patients too much. But I think many of us felt we had the experience that the more we scan the patients, the more we appreciate the frequency of scanning, because we realize that patients having new lesions every new scan, that's not prognostically so good. So by starting using something, I think we'll see the benefit of it. And we also have to develop, let's say, reference levels and maybe kinetics on neurofilament that is associated with a negative prognostic outlook. So we'll learn how to interpret and use the data.
Thank you, Frederick. I really think you've changed my mind on plasma neurofilament light levels. They really seem practical and potentially can both help decrease expensive imaging, as we mentioned, and perhaps be much more sensitive than the volumetric imaging, which I think, while helpful over a longer term, it's nice to know and patients want to know, how am I doing now? Again, I've been talking with Frederick Peel, professor of neurology at Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, Sweden. We've been discussing his paper, Blood Neurofilament Light Levels, Segregate Treatment Effects in Multiple Sclerosis Patients, published in this issue of Neurology. If you want to listen to more podcasts on neurofilament light, please listen back to our April 29th, 2019 edition on neurofilament light and Alzheimer's, and then also our May 9th, 2017 edition on mild TBI and contact sports. Thank you again, Frederick, for joining us today.
Thank you, David.
This is Bob Gross again. Please check out this week's journal, which features an interesting article on clinical and therapeutic features of myasthenia gravis in adults based on age of onset, and an article on the effects of acute sleep loss on diurnal plasma dynamics of CNS health biomarkers in young men. And don't forget to check out Neurology's three subspecialty journals, Neurology Genetics, Neurology Neuroimmunology and Neuroinflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice, as well as our mini-sites on equity, diversity, and inclusion, global neurology, and innovations in care delivery. Thank you again for listening, and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.